You are listening to the Health and Wellness Connection Podcast, the number one wellness podcast designed to provide the latest information to help you achieve your health and wellness goals. Our show features exciting guests, the latest in medical research, and in-depth discussions in current trends on weight loss, nutrition, and fitness. No matter what your interest, the Health and Wellness Podcast has you covered. And now, presenting your illustrious host, Dr. Barry, MD.
Hello, hello, guys, and welcome back to the Health and Wellness Connection. It's your host, Dr. Barry, and I'm so excited to be here again to chat with you a little bit about some of the latest news on the health and wellness front. Now, of course, for those who don't know, this may be your first episode. We are a podcast designed on looking at the up-to-date latest research and presenting to you, in a non-biased manner. We're fully independent. We're out here just doing the work, just reading and educating folks about, some of the latest research and wellness news. Now, of course, before I even go any further, I am Dr. Barry. I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician, been in practice for over 10 years. Also am a health and wellness physician who has worked with many patients helping them with weight loss and wellness. And we're here to kind of make sure people have access to good information, because one thing that we do know about kind of life is that those who have the information tend to succeed. Like, ignorance is one of the biggest reasons why people tend to not be able to thrive, and having good information, usually pays dividends, in your life in many different ways. So we focus on the health and wellness, obviously, making sure that any information we present is researched back, and we tend to, let you know where you can go and find that information as well. We use a lot of different sources, including Medscape.com, Healthline, different online blogs, research articles, and the like. So, we try to make sure we do a good job as far as vetting information before we present it. And of course, hopefully, we break it down in a way that anyone can understand it, so that you can have a better understanding of what's out there. So, that being said, because we are independent, we do appreciate your donations. There's many ways you can contribute. If you're on the Anchor webpage, there is a link you can actually donate from via the webpage. Also, if you're a fan of Cash App, we do have a Cash App, $ Dr. Barry Health. That's D as in dog, R, B as in boy, A-R-R-Y, H-E-A-L-T-H. We got to do the commercials because that's how we pay the bills. If you want to reach out to myself, the host, Dr. Barry, or the staff here, as we, if you have any information regarding future topics you'd like for us to discuss, please do not hesitate to reach out. Email is Dr. Barry Health, that's D-R, B as in boy, A-R-R-Y, H-E-A-L-T-H, @gmail.com. Again, Dr. Barry Health @gmail.com. Alrighty, so first things first, let's get into the news of the week. Now, there are a lot of great topics that have been kind of coming across my wire, and I've been trying to organize them the best way I can, and, it's just kind of interesting, kind of the different things that are popping up, and just reaffirming some of the things we already know about, some of our health and wellness issues. We are going to talk about some of the benefits of some foods that we already suspected were great for your health and wellness, like black tea. New research is coming out showing that it's actually linked to lower risk of cardiovascular death. Also, we saw an article that also talked about sleep loss being linked to reduced generosity. So, and also some new info regarding psychedelic drug therapy and how it may be, showing some really good signs as far as treating depression and alcoholism. So, interesting topics of the day or the week, we're going to discuss. And let's do it. So, first things first, monkeypox has been in the news. I know we've talked about monkeypox a lot, one thing we've noticed about monkeypox is that it's still something that, is of concern. And therefore, there are many people looking at ways to help reduce spread and infection. Now, one thing that has been seen with monkeypox is that, people who engage in homosexual activity, particularly men having sex with men, noted that there was particularly high levels of new infections in this group. But when they dove down deeper into in the group as far as, you know, males who have sex with males and why there was a notable increase in infection rates, it was found that people who had actually more than one partner in the past 3 weeks were actually particularly susceptible, meaning they had a 1.8 to 6.9 times risk for monkeypox infection compared to those who had one partner in the past 3 weeks. So just a significant boost of people who are at increased risk are those who are, you know, engaging in promiscuous sexual activity. Now, the good news is that most males who have sex with males typically do not engage in high-risk sexual behavior. It's believed that people who have these one-time partnerships, meaning one new partner every 3 weeks, is about less than 3% of daily partnerships. So, you know, that's a pretty small amount. However, you know, if there's something that's spreading quickly, you know, even that 3% can have an impact. So I think it's important that we put things in perspective. But that being said, it was realized that, you know, if people would just reduce their, you know, promiscuous behavior, that would probably do a significant job in reducing the spread of this virus. So, the monkeypox virus is still something that people are monitoring. It's believed that, you know, since May, U.S. has about 17,000 monkeypox cases, and is primarily in the gay and bisexual male demographic. So I think that it's believed that if, you know, things can be done to help kind of this group particularly, you know, engage in safer activities, we can probably reduce the spread of this virus. That being said, you know, this is not exclusive to males, obviously. Females and other groups can be affected. So you still want to be very careful as far as how you're, you know, interacting with other people, especially if on the intimate level, you want to make sure you're not having close contact with sick people who have significant lesions, things like that. I mean, it's obvious things you should look out for. And, you know, ultimately, I think it just shows the importance of making sure that if you're engaging in, you know, sexual activity, you're doing your best to protect yourself. And you're also making sure that your partners are also, you know, cleaned as far as, you know, they're ill, they're sick, or have lesions, they're, you know, quarantining themselves until they're better. So interesting. But the funny thing about monkeypox is that it's something that has visited for a long time and, you know, hasn't really had a lot of attention. So it's kind of curious seeing how, you know, more attention is being spread to this illness due to, you know, the groups and the different areas that it's now infecting. And, you know, speaking of monkeypox, one thing that was actually seen, which is actually been considered a first, there's one individual who was actually found to be diagnosed with both with three different viruses at the same time: COVID-19, monkeypox, and HIV. So this is actually a case report that was published recently in the Journal of Infection. You know, this is something that really hadn't been seen before. And the funny thing is, despite having all these infections, the patient actually is doing well, except for the HIV, obviously, which is still going to require continuous treatment. But so just be real out here, guys. There's a lot of infectious illnesses out here that you can easily get if you're not careful. And like this unfortunate gentleman from Italy who had all three, you know, this is a reality. Especially if you're in a high-risk group engaging in high-risk behavior. All right, now the next article talks about one of the more popular drugs that we've mentioned on this show many times, and that is regarding the antiviral drug Paxlovid. So this is the new drug that's being used now to treat COVID-19 infections. And the data coming out lately is showing that this drug is pretty effective. Now, of course, as we stated before in previous shows, this drug was made by Pfizer and was recently approved as being actually made available now to anyone who wants it without a doctor's prescription due to new FDA Emergency Use Authorization Act that was placed. It was actually made so that it can be made available to anyone between the ages of 12 and older. So Paxlovid is, you know, the new thing apparently, and research is showing that this drug is actually showing good evidence of reducing symptoms and hospitalizations, as well as deaths attributed to COVID-19. It's believed that the data that we're looking at today comes out of Israel. It was a Dr. Doron Netzer who actually looked at some data from patients in a Israeli health database where they looked at patients who had been treated for COVID-19, and they looked at patients who were treated with Paxlovid versus those who were not. Now, again, it was actually pretty pretty thorough as far as the power of the study, because they looked at over a million patients. They looked at a million patients who were treated for COVID-19 in their health system. 109,000 actually patients were considered high risk who became ill, and 4,000 of those patients actually were treated with Paxlovid. Average age of the patients involved in this kind of data analysis was 60 years old, and 40% of the patients were 65 and older. So ultimately, the patients were an older group, considered the high risk group. So it was very, effective as far as looking at Paxlovid and how effective it is in treating these high risk groups. Because we know before the pandemic, before these drugs came on board, people who had COVID and were older were especially susceptible to complications and death from COVID-19. So it was definitely very, very serious as far as that group and their potential risk of getting COVID-19. So it's great news that, Paxlovid was shown that it was very effective in reducing people's risk of dying and death from COVID-19. And when you look at the data even closer, it was actually pretty remarkable how effective the drug was in reducing the risk of hospitalization in patients who are 65 years and older. In this particular study, they found that out of 100,000 people who were treated for COVID-19, 65 and older, about 14 cases out of 100,000 required hospitalization in the groups that received the medication or Paxlovid. And in the group that did not receive the Paxlovid, 60 out of 100,000 became hospitalized. So, almost a 73% chance, 70% lower chance of being hospitalized. In a nutshell, people who took the medication, especially the older group, had a markedly decreased risk of hospitalization, almost 73%. So, it's definitely showing that in the older group, this medication can be extremely effective in helping reduce, progression to, pretty severe illness, which is always a concern with COVID-19 infections. All right. So in a nutshell, if you do get sick, especially if you're older and high risk, you definitely want to make sure, you inquire about Paxlovid. You actually do not need a doctor's prescription now. You can go straight to the pharmacy and get it, and you can get it straight from the pharmacist. So, all right. So now moving on, the next study that we looked at kind of looks at black tea. And black tea, which is something that, we've talked about previously on prior episodes, is due to its very beneficial health benefits. And we've kind of alluded to some of these already, especially with the presence of antioxidants, which are something that black tea has a lot of. But it's always good to see the research kind of validate those theories that are being proposed. So this study came out of the UK, actually being published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, so a very big medical journal. And they looked at 500,000 participants in the UK Biobank. Again, this is a big database in the United States, in the United Kingdom, where they looked at data and they do kind of analysis based on the patient they're treating in the UK health system. A lot of studies have been done using the UK Biobank. So it's a very popular resource for many researchers to kind of look at human health treatment patterns and how effective they are, what may be causing certain illnesses. It's a very powerful tool to analyze, human health and wellness. Now, in this study, they looked at black tea, looked at those who, admitted to drinking a black tea daily as far as their routine, lifestyle. Now, they looked at those who just kind of looked at those who consumed black tea versus those who didn't. Then they followed up with these same people 12 years later, looking at their health files, see what they were involved in, if they died, if they got sick, what kind of illnesses they got, and looking at, the rate of illnesses based on, how much tea they consumed. Now, they looked at different levels of consumption, by the way, daily intake of one cup versus, someone who drank 4 to 5 cups versus someone who drank 8 to 9 cups. They kind of looked at how much tea you were drinking per day, and looked at that correlation with presence of other illnesses, deaths, and other issues as they aged. Now, what they found was that those who drank tea, showed an inverse association with mortality, meaning the more tea they drank, the less likelihood of them having, heart-related illnesses like heart attacks, heart failures, and the like. So pretty significant drop that. So again, they noted that those who drank more tea had a lower risk of heart attacks, strokes, and similar cardiovascular ailments. Now, there was no association with cancer and cancer mortality in this study. And again, this is just looking at the data after, you know, people are doing their thing. You're assuming they're telling the truth as far as how much tea they're drinking. And it was essentially kind of a, what we call this, a retro analysis. They kind of look back at data after it's already been generated. They may not have controlled it, but they're just kind of trying to eliminate those potential traits that can make the data less useful. And in this case, they looked at older individuals. Mean group was 56 years of age. And they looked at people, you know, how they consume tea, and then how much of these same people had heart attacks. And there was essentially association with increased tea drinking resulting in decreased amounts of heart attacks and strokes. So, you know, because it's not as powerful as a forward study where we can look at people and monitor what they're doing as they do it, you know, it's definitely not as powerful as some of the other data we've looked at. But given the size and, you know, I think there is something that we could potentially do more research on in this area as far as looking at the association between black tea and the effect on the heart, and if it truly does or can help reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke, I think it would be something that people would be interested in learning more about. So hopefully we'll see more research in this area, and we'll be sure to bring it to you if we do. All right, now the next article, very interesting article, and it's talking about alcohol use. And we know alcohol is something that, you know, people enjoy ingesting all across the world. Despite, you know, some of the popularity that it may have, there's one thing we do know about alcohol, and that it is linked to cancer. It's one of the considered one of the most preventable risk factors for cancer, because technically you don't need alcohol to survive, but some people do believe they drink alcohol, they feel a sense of euphoria or enjoyment, if you will. Now, new research coming out of the Journal of American Medical, of the Journal of American Medical Association, you know, looked at alcohol and, you know, noted that, you know, this actually was from Korea, by the way, and they looked at alcohol consumption and cancer, and they noted those who were drinking certain levels of alcohol were found to have a significantly increased risk of various cancers. And then they noted that people who reduced their use of alcohol were associated with a lower risk of cancer, especially if they were considered heavy drinkers, like they were drinking, you know, 2-3 drinks a day or more every day. And it was believed that, you know, people who drank 3 or more beverages a day and higher, and they reduced that, there was a significant reduction in their cancer risk as they progressed in life. So, you know, it's very important showing that alcohol kind of having a direct risk on cancers and the, you know, and getting cancer. And, you know, I think it's very important that we, you know, remember that. Now, when we say cancer, alcohol is one of those conditions that typically, you know, in itself is a carcinogen. So when you consume it, anything that it comes in contact with can technically be at higher risk for cancer. Now, that being said, you do have a liver which helps detoxify things that you consume like alcohol, and can help reduce, you know, its effect on the body. But, you know, some people are trying to overdo it and wear out their liver, and that can result in a lot of issues, you know, going forward. Now, one thing that was found as far as when we say alcohol and cancer, what cancer specifically, you ask? Well, the main cancers that we see associated with alcohol are particularly oral cavity pharyngeal cancers, so mouth cancers, throat cancers, GI cancers, you know, stomach cancer, things like that. Also, greater than 25% of laryngeal cancers, female breast cancer, colorectal cancer, liver cancer, and esophageal cancer. So, you know, essentially anywhere where alcohol touches is theoretically at a higher risk for cancer. Now, of course, you know, getting exact risk percentages, you know, it's hard to really say, but we do know that alcohol is responsible for about 4% of all newly diagnosed cancers worldwide. So, you know, worldwide cancer definitely levels are elevated due to alcohol consumption, and you know, it is what it is. Now, this study particularly was done in Korea, like we said, South Korea. I doubt North Korea was involved in the study, but I don't think Kim Jong-il will be interested in participating in research that would benefit the outside world. But either way, so they looked at 4.5 million individuals. So quite a large group of individuals that were looked at. Mean age of this group was 53 years old. And they went through health screening from 2009 and 2011. And they followed them up about 6 years later and looked at the risk of cancer based on those, you know, who reported alcohol consumption. You know, like I said, they were mild drinkers, always the heavy drinkers. They looked at the levels of consumption and then who had cancer, who didn't. And like we said, those who, you know, drank moderate to heavy, who went from heavy to moderate, as well as heavy to mild, definitely saw significant reductions in their cancer risk. And those who had the heaviest drinking also had the heaviest levels or highest levels of cancer diagnoses. So, you know, this is a very, I think, very helpful study as far as looking at the association between alcohol and cancer. And we do, you know, we already kind of knew that, but ultimately, I think more evidence confirming, you know, the dangers of alcohol and heavy consumption and potential cancer risk is important to keep it in perspective, you know. So, all right, so speaking of alcohol, alcohol addiction is something that has been also a very big issue in the health and wellness arena. People who, you know, tend to drink a lot tend to develop an addiction, which, you know, requires continued drinking and just kind of creates a very dangerous spiral. So getting off alcohol has been a huge, you know, problem for many people, and there's been different ways to help people, you know, address alcohol addiction and even medications that you can get, which, you know, we can talk about more offline if you're someone who thinks you need help with alcohol addiction. But new therapy that's coming, that's being researched now, is looking at a potential use case for psilocybin. You know, and this is also paired with psychotherapy as well, you know, by the way, they feel can help with potential alcohol use disorder or alcohol addiction. Now, a recent study was done. This actually came out of the Journal of American Medical Association Psychiatry Journal. And research was done here in the United States of America, particularly in NYU, the Center of Psychedelic Medicine. Senior investigator was Michael Bogenschultz. But either way, so definitely, I think, something that needs more investigation, including psilocybin. Now, they looked at patients who were being treated for alcohol addiction. Now, it was a very small study, by the way. 93 adults, mean age was 46 years of age. And these people who were being treated in this center with alcohol, for alcohol dependence, because they consumed about 7 drinks a day or more. And they had even more days of heavy drinking. So really heavy drinking, alcohol use. Now, out of these 93 individuals, they looked at people who, you know, were going to be, basically they divided them into two groups. One group was going to be treated with psilocybin and psychotherapy. Another group was getting psychotherapy and placebo. And they looked at people in both groups, and they, you know, basically for 12 weeks period, and they researched kind of how they were doing and whether or not they relapsed into alcohol heavy usage, you know, despite the psychotherapy over the 12 weeks, and just kind of overall, you know, psychological and psychotherapy management. Now, they still let them drink, you know, despite the group, and they wanted them to, even though they were trying to quit, so they were going to fight to not drink, obviously, but they did allow them to kind of do their own thing. So if they did relapse, that was part of the study, to see what would be more effective. Now, even though the psychotherapy went on for 12 weeks, they actually came back 32 weeks after the first session began to assess to see who had relapsed. So again, 12 weeks psychotherapy, one group got psilocybin, the other group got placebo. So after 12 weeks was over, they let them do their thing, kind of go about their daily life. And they checked back 32 weeks later at the 32 week mark to see how they were doing. What they found was pretty interesting. Now, the percentage of people who, you know, relapsed as far as went back to heavy drinking, meaning like 4 or 5 drinks a day, heavy binge drinking on the weekend, the group that took psilocybin, only 10% apparently relapsed, so about 4 people out of the 40. Meanwhile, the groups who are on the placebo, 23% relapse, so almost more than double, almost triple relapse in the placebo group. So, you know, out of the four, almost like 12, you know, almost went back and started drinking. So pretty, you know, significant kind of percentage differences here, meaning that those who were on the psilocybin were able to refrain from heavy drinking and refrain from relapsing far more successfully than those who were on the placebo. So while psychotherapy, you know, I'm sure helped as well, but we see that with psilocybin, they were completely able to refrain or reduce their ingestion of alcohol significantly. And then they went back again 7 months later, and they found that out of the two groups that were, you know, being treated, 48% of the psilocybin group was completely abstinent, meaning almost half of them had just given up alcohol altogether, and versus 24% of the placebo group had given up alcohol. So, I mean, pretty significant, you know, effects here, where with psilocybin, they were able to almost, you know, have a markedly successful treatment plan for these patients, as opposed to just talking to them and doing psychotherapy. Now, some could argue that psilocybin does have some effects on the sensorium and can alter people's sensations, that they were able to maybe tolerate some of the withdrawal effects better. But, you know, because that's withdrawal is usually one of the big things that causes people to relapse who have a dependency to alcohol. So hopefully those were addressed in the psychotherapy group only. But, you know, I think that this is pretty impressive for psilocybin. And it's calling, and this is why many psychiatrists and other specialists are calling for potential, you know, use of psilocybin to help treat patients who have alcohol dependence and other ailments. And there's even some new data coming out looking at its use in the treatment of depression. So we're going to have some specialists come on the show and talk about more about psilocybin and some of the applications that are being kind of, you know, proposed, especially in the psychiatric community. So we're going to look out for that. But yes, psilocybin and the alcohol dependence may be, you know, I think, an effective way to get people off of alcohol addiction. We're going to keep looking more for information in this area. All right, guys. So this is going to be the last story of the week, and a pretty interesting story, actually. And talking about sleep loss and the potential for it being associated with reduced generosity. And in other words, you know, if you're not sleeping well, you're probably going to be more stingy, more miserable. Now, of course, you know, I'm sure the whole idea of someone being grumpy because, you know, they're not sleeping well is not new to many of us. But again, we got some research out here that's looking directly at the potential for just objectively, you know, provable reductions in altruism and sincerity and generosity simply because people are not getting enough sleep. Now, this study comes out of the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Edie Ben Simone, PhD, who actually, you know, conducted this study, I guess, in his area. And they looked at, you know, people who were sleep deprived. They actually created a small little research kind of experiment where they had people who didn't sleep, and then they would ask them a series of questions regarding kind of their behavior and what they would do in certain situations. Now, this was a very, very small study. Approximately about 23 people who were in the study, and they looked at folks, you know, who did a 40 item questionnaire. They made them fill out these questions after, you know, one was done after a rested night of sleep, and then they did another group where they had them do the questions after 24 hours of sleep deprivation. So, you know, it was pretty interesting. They looked at folks, you know, they looked at them, and then they had them answer questions after a regular full night's rest. And then they went again and kept them up all night and then asked some similar questions, but kind of assessing their altruism. One of the questions, example, will be like, if I was in a hurry to get to work and someone stopped me to ask for directions, I would, you know, would you sell them the F off, or would you tell them where to go? You know, just seeing how helpful they would be to other people, you know, depending on, you know, their sleep situation. And what it found was that, you know, which you probably could guess, those who didn't sleep were extremely, like, more rude, more refusing to help people, you know, could care less about other people's plights, less generous, especially how they answered the questions. So I think it answers a lot of kind of people's suspicions regarding, you know, how important sleep is as far as our mood and our overall, you know, affect. You know, if you're not sleeping well, chances are you're going to be very grumpy, very miserable, less likely to help others. And this is something that's even being seen on MRI. They actually looked at people's, they did MRIs of everybody as well, especially those after the night of sleep deprivation. And they looked at areas of the brain that were involved in social cognition, and they found that there was significant impairment in these areas that affect social cognition. So, you know, social cognition is, again, just understanding, you know, the social dynamics and being able to navigate those, typically with measured and kind of appropriate responses. But it was found that those who, you know, were sleep deprived had significant issues as far as the part of the brain that's involved in social cognition. And another part of the study even looked at the how daylight savings time affects people's charitable contributions. So what they did was they looked at various organizations that typically receive, you know, regular contributions around the year. They looked at this over a 15-year period. So I think it was pretty impressive. They went and just got the data from different groups and asked, you know, them to give them kind of the general donations every month for these years. And they found that during the daylight savings periods, there was a significant decrease in donations. So, you know, during the years of donations, you know, spring forward and fall backwards, those particular days where we set our clocks, particularly when we're losing sleep, right? So spring forward is, you know, really notorious for this. As far as people getting less sleep, people tend to be more tired, more grumpy. But there was actually able to see that there was a significant level of donations during these periods when the, you know, clocks are moved forward. Now, these same reductions apparently were not seen in areas that do not observe daylight savings. So it's pretty crazy. Areas that don't observe daylight savings had no changes as far as their donation regularity and the amounts, versus those that, you know, had daylight savings, the charitable organizations in these regions noted decreased amounts of donations. You know, almost in numbers low, much almost like 10% less. So it just shows the power of sleep and how, you know, being chronically sleep deprived can have issues and pretty significant effects on your personality, how your brain functions and thinks, and you know, it even has ramifications throughout society. So, like I always say, guys, get your sleep. It's very important, and this goes to show you why. So, that being said, guys, thanks again for checking us out. We are, you know, out here trying to keep giving you that good content. Make sure if you have any questions or any kind of, you know, feedback, we'd love to hear it. Email us at drberryhealth@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Instagram at drberrymd. Again, guys, it's a pleasure bringing you the show. Any support will be greatly appreciated. And for that, and to that, I should say, we will say goodbye. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Health and Wellness Connection podcast and radio show. For more information on ways to get healthy, please check us out. www.anchor.fm/HW Connection. Here you can re-listen to the show, check out older shows, and even further support the show by becoming a subscriber to the podcast. Please check us out today. Again, that's anchor.fm/HW Connection. And also, don't forget to follow Dr. Berry on Instagram @drberrymd. Until next time, stay healthy.